It leaves the church with a number of very untidy relationships, let's say. Undoubtedly, there's a huge crisis looming.
For a large part of Islam's history, it's been very tolerant of minorities within its borders.
And that included tolerance of homosexuality.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
I know that most 13-year-old boys like to imagine themselves as aging women. Oh, yeah, it's a hoot! We're all sitting here naked.
Oh, wait a minute, you're saying that the women in your film were not played by women?
We were hoping for Girls Will Be Girls on Ice.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Contradictions characterize the Anglican Communion's gay clergy clash. Scholars revise interpretations to revive Islamic tolerance. And boys who are girls will be girls in a film festival favorite. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 18th, 2003. California this week became the first of the United States to enact a requirement that its contractors extend the same benefits to the domestic partners of their unmarried employees as to their married employees' spouses. Outgoing Democratic Governor Gray Davis, who in a special election last week became only the second U.S. governor ever to be recalled, signed the bill, although it would also have become law the same day had he simply not acted on it. The new law, a statewide version of San Francisco's pioneering 1996 Equal Benefits Ordinance, was written by openly lesbian Democratic Assembly member from San Diego, Christine Kehoe, currently also the acting Assembly Speaker. It will not take effect until 2007 to allow contractors time to comply. It applies only to contracts worth at least $100,000. It was opposed in large part on religious grounds by groups including the Mormon Church and Roman Catholic hospitals and passed the legislature only by narrow margins. How future gay and lesbian equality legislation will fare under Republican Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger, a self-identified social moderate, is still unclear.
This week was Marriage Protection Week in the U.S., as officially proclaimed by Republican President George W. Bush. An analysis by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force found that all the week's official activities and both its suggested sermons were exclusively directed towards preventing legal recognition of same-gender couples, particularly the proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution to restrict marriage to one man and one woman. Examining the websites of nine of the week's 29 sponsoring groups, NGLTF also found many more references to homosexual than to such issues as divorce, poverty, or domestic violence. Naturally, NGLTF took particular issue with the sponsor's declaration of the wealth and power of the lesbian gay lobby. They say that just 13 of the 29 sponsors, not necessarily the wealthiest, just those with accessible financial information, have a total income more than four times that of the 13 best-funded national lesbian and gay advocacy groups.
However, Marriage Protection Week did not actually prove highly visible outside of Christian media and participating churches. Coming as it did in the week, including National Coming Out Day and related observances, there were ready-made opportunities for counter-demonstrations supporting equal marriage rights, particularly on university campuses. Several of those featured wedding ceremonies.
The largest U.S. gay and lesbian advocacy group, the Human Rights Campaign, ran a full-page ad in the New York Times denouncing both Marriage Protection Week and the proposed federal marriage amendment and urging fairness.
The Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund staged an online forum entitled Queer Eye for the Straight Couple, taking off from the similarly named TV makeover show to have heterosexual couples receive relationship advice from gays and lesbians.
In Massachusetts and Connecticut, where civil unions are under active consideration, perhaps a dozen assorted clergy declared they would not marry heterosexual couples until they could marry gay and lesbian couples. The group included a Jewish rabbi, a Presbyterian minister, and ministers from the United Church of Christ and the Unitarian Universalist Church. Unitarians in Connecticut also joined activists from Yale University in staging a demonstration in New Haven supporting equal marriage rights.
The threat of schism in the global Anglican Communion over a Canadian diocese blessing same-gender relationships and the U.S. election of an openly partnered gay man to a bishopric was hardly altered by a special meeting of the church's primates in London this week. Division is so deep that it's widely viewed as an achievement that all the parties stayed in the room for the two-day session, much less that they went on to produce a unanimous statement. Anglican First Among Equals Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams is hopeful that the agreement bought a year or so of thinking time, staving off hasty actions in what he acknowledges is a crisis period for the church. He told the BBC this week,
"Undoubtedly, there's a huge crisis looming. I think what we've achieved this week, though, is at least to find some way of talking through the crisis without instantly jumping into what appear to be quick solutions. When and if the ordination of Jean Robinson goes ahead in the United States, we shall immediately have some responses around the world, I'm sure. But what we've done is to give ourselves a sort of 12-month-plus thinking time, inviting provinces to reflect on their reactions."
Because the denomination is much more a coalition than a hierarchy, the primates are relatively powerless. The most tangible impact of the agreement is the classic delaying measure of creating a committee, in this case charged with exploring how spiritual needs can be met despite the division. That means particularly the needs of conservatives in liberal dioceses, as the primates called on the U.S. Episcopal dioceses to provide alternative leadership for those who object to gay or lesbian priests.
Where the primates do have some power is in asserting the teachings of the Anglican Church, and they explicitly declared that the Vancouver area New Westminster Diocese and the U.S. Episcopal Church have not altered unilaterally the teaching of the Anglican Communion on homosexuality. They reaffirmed the moral force of the resolutions of the 1998 Decennial Lambeth Conference of the World's Anglican Bishops, which by large margins found homosexual acts incompatible with Scripture, rejected ordination of non-celibate gays and lesbians, and rejected blessings for same-gender couples. The statement did underscore the one gay-friendly resolution of that conference, which called on Anglicans to listen to the experience of homosexual persons and to assure them that they are loved by God and are full members of the body of Christ. But that may not actually be happening, since reportedly some of the most vehemently anti-gay African primates have never knowingly met a gay man or lesbian.
The primates stated that, "As a body, we deeply regret the actions of the Diocese of New Westminster and the Episcopal Church USA." While affirming the autonomy of the church's regional provinces, they wrote that, "Nevertheless, many primates have pointed to the grave difficulties raised by the election of gay Jean Robinson to Bishop of New Hampshire, and noted that, in most of our provinces, his election would not have been possible." They went on to say, "If his consecration proceeds, we have had to conclude that the future of the communion itself will be put in jeopardy. In this case, the ministry of this one bishop will not be recognized by most of the Anglican world, and many provinces are likely to consider themselves out of communion with the Episcopal Church USA. This will tear the fabric of our communion at its deepest level. Similar considerations apply to the situation pertaining in the Diocese of New Westminster regarding blessings for same-gender couples."
Robinson's consecration as bishop is scheduled for November 2nd, and he has no intention of backing out. Gay supportive U.S. primate Frank Griswold affirmed his respect both for the Episcopal Church's process in choosing Robinson and for the primate's document, without explaining the contradiction or indicating what action he will take. Currently, he's scheduled to attend the consecration. The New Hampshire diocese reaffirmed its support for Robinson. Again, Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams in that BBC interview.
"It leaves the church with a number of very untidy relationships, let's say, where there may be a number of provinces who will declare outright that they're not in communion in the long run, though we would hope to find ways of living with that, others which would want to continue in an impaired state of relation. And, of course, what complicates matters where the Anglican Church is concerned is that we're not a single monolithic body with a single decision-making authority. Our communion depends a great deal on relationships rather than rules, and it's those relationships that are strained at the moment and will be even more so."
Canada's gay supportive primate, Michael Pearce, told reporters of the primates, "We agreed to disagree. We are still in communion, but there are dark, dark clouds on the horizon."
The horizon looks brighter, though, for gays and lesbians in Australia's Northern Territory. This week, a bill was introduced in the territorial parliament that includes a range of reforms towards equality. Reforms would include lowering the age of consent for homosexual acts from 18 to 16, the age of consent for heterosexual acts, strengthening the territorial law against discrimination by removing some of its discriminatory exemptions, and establishing recognition of same-gender couples. Darwin Community Legal Service played a significant role in developing the reform package, as was acknowledged before the parliament.
The government of Malta last week created new protections from job discrimination based on sexual orientation, with publication of a legal notice instructing the Industrial Tribunal to follow European Union directives. Malta will become an EU member next year, but the European Commission had expressed concern that national laws did not adequately protect gays and lesbians. The group Malta Gay Rights Movement called the decree a good first step, but notes that it could be withdrawn as easily as it was issued and that it does not adequately respond to harassment issues.
And finally, in Britain, a new special edition of Monopoly is being hailed as the first family board game to include a gay and lesbian organization. The game board's representation of Brighton and Hove includes a square for Brighton Pride at the usual kickoff point for the festival's parade. Surprisingly strong advanced sales have already spurred the manufacturer to increase their initial production even before it's hit the stores.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 18th, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Girls Will Be Girls has been hailed as the best 79-minute drag comedy of the last few months. We'll separate the movie-making men from the girls later in the program.
The average person in the West has a certain understanding of Islam. They can be pretty brutal towards people who are accused of being homosexual.
It depends on interpretation. I mean, for centuries, Europeans regarded the Islamic world as the place that you went to if you wanted to have gay sex.
Historical and social context do make all the difference in analyzing the Islamic view of homosexuality. In the first part of our special feature on Islam and the lesbo-gay community, Dr. James Wafer argued that the Muslim world has replaced the Soviet Union as capitalism's global counterpart and that a new era of Islamic thought may be on the horizon. A gay social anthropologist and former Muslim convert, Wafer contributed two articles to the anthology Islamic Homosexualities, Culture, History, and Literature, edited by Stephen O. Murray and Will Roscoe. As his conversation with This Way Out correspondent Michael Schembri concludes, Wafer says there's hope for a return to Islam's historic tolerance.
Within Christianity, it's become possible over the last few decades to provide different interpretations of the Bible, Old and New Testaments. Part of that has been to challenge the sexism of the Bible, so there's Christian feminism. And part of it has been to question what the Bible, how to interpret the Bible regarding homosexuality. Part of that has been to historicize the Bible and say, well, if slavery was okay then, but it's not now, then why do you insist on being anti-homosexual now just because it was bad at that time? Is there a comparable development within Islamic studies?
It's only just beginning. I had an email recently from a Muslim student at a theological college in Canada who was doing some activist work to support Muslim youth who'd been gays and lesbians, who'd been thrown out of their homes by their parents because they'd come out. She's a theologian, a Muslim theologian, and she's looking for this kind of accommodation between the Prophet's sayings on things like freedom and justice to counterbalance sayings of the Prophet's followers, which it is really the Prophet's followers who are responsible for the anti-homosexual bent in certain schools of Islam, not the Prophet himself, I don't think. And this woman's trying to do a sort of revisionist reading of Islamic theology from that perspective. And all power to her and to all those who are doing it, because I think it's been a very important step for Christianity, and I think it would be a major step for Islam. Very difficult, though, because the traditions are structured quite differently.
So there would be opposition both within the masses of believers as well as the strong and dangerous resistance from the decision makers in Islam.
I think that's right, but then you have to consider that it's taken us 30 years to bring about the changes that have happened with regard to homosexuality in places as liberal as Australia, you know, and certainly there are places in the West that are not as liberal as Australia. Certain states in the United States, for example. It's not going to be a fast road, but I think that the fact that there are people actually proposing it and even making attempts at it at this stage is really important.
You suggest in your writing that the way forward for gay and lesbian Muslims is this way, through reinterpretation, especially of the sayings of the Prophet. You still have the opinion?
I think so. I think Islam is a kind of culture where secular rationalism is an option, but less an option than it is for Christians. In Islam, you grow up in a world where you say the daily prayers five times a day. You observe the fast of Ramadan for a month once a year. There's a very heavy inculcation of the faith. So completely abandoning the religion for secular rationalism is certainly a possibility. But to my mind, the world is more interesting for being a diverse place. And I just think it's an interesting option to have a form of Islam that actually is sympathetic towards homosexuality than to have gay and lesbian Muslims have to throw out their faith because they're gay or lesbian.
I'm suggesting, though, that a form of gay and lesbian liberation through Islam would
right.
have its own limitations, especially in the situation where there might be gay men and lesbians who certainly do not wish to be Muslim. And certainly currently in a lot of Muslim countries, there are significant populations who are not Muslim.
Right.
Secular development,
yes. Yes.
Separation of religion and state,
yes.
would
yes.
be a fuller form of freedom.
Certainly, in those states where there is a religious government, which is the aim of some forms of revolutionary Islam, is to set up the traditional form of religious government. Traditionally, in Islam, there was no separation between the religion and the state. I mean, they were the same thing. The religious authorities were the secular authorities as well.
Like the Vatican in olden times.
Exactly, exactly. And in the contemporary world, we have most large Muslim states, like Indonesia, there is a separation between the religion and the state. Indonesia is not technically a Muslim state, even though it has a majority population of Muslims.
For that matter, neither are Iraq, Syria, or Tunisia.
Right, yes, indeed. So the notion of a Muslim state is one that brings with it a lot of risks, because it means that the kind of interpretation of the traditional law that comes with it could be extremely fundamentalist. I mean, it depends what kind of Muslim state it is. This is in spite of the fact that for a large part of Islam's history, it's been very tolerant of minorities within its borders. Under the Ottomans, for example, there was a great degree of religious tolerance in Muslim Spain as well. There was more religious tolerance in Muslim Spain than there was in Christian Spain.
And that included the tolerance of homosexuality?
Yes, indeed, indeed. So you can't see Islam as one single thing that is uniform and static over time. You know, it's been a variety of different things, and it will be a variety of different things in the future.
Dr. James Wafer, who was interviewed by Michael Schembri, is a contributor to the anthology Islamic Homosexualities, Culture, History, and Literature, published by New York University Press. Another indication of the changes beginning in Islam has come with the fifth anniversary of Al-Fatiha, a U.S.-based organization serving the needs of queer Muslims. In addition to sponsoring the publication of a booklet on new gay supportive interpretations of Islam, Al-Fatiha plans in the coming year to launch an asylum project and a series of empowerment seminars for lesbian, bi, and trans Muslim women. You can find Al-Fatiha online at www.alfatiha.net. That's al-fatiha.net.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, or for audio cassette subscription information, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And thanks to AlternaBid and the Stonewall Society, you can still bid on some terrific items in an online auction to benefit This Way Out. Look for the This Way Out auction area at AlternaBid.com. Some critics of the film Girls Will Be Girls have said that its storyline is two-dimensional and vulgar, and that its characters are acid-tongued, shallow, and bitchy. And of course, they're absolutely right. This Way Out's Steve Pride met with the film's director, Richard Day, and visited its trio of stars, Coco Peru, Evie Harris, and Varla Jean Merman, and says he got the dirt. And now it's time to get dirty.
The place, Hollywood, California. The reason? Evie, Coco, and Varla. They say good things come in threes, or is that death? Nonetheless, much like the Three Musketeers, the Three Stooges, or the Three Little Pigs, this trio of plus-size gals is taking Tinseltown by storm. In what's being hailed as the best 79-minute drag comedy of the last few months, their new film, Girls Will Be Girls, tells the story of Evie, an aging actress who's more lush than luscious, Coco, who longs for a child with the doctor who performed her abortions, and Varla, a big-bone ingenue with dreams of Hollywood stardom and more grit than a discount oyster.
Nothing like that first puke of the day. Martini?
Oh, happy hour for me never starts till after five.
Me either. This is only number three.
Varla was just telling me all about how she came here from Arkansas.
Right, to become a big movie star.
And singing sensation.
Oh.
Well, you know, it's not as simple as just showing up. You also have to fill out the application.
I realize how tough it can be, but that's why I have a plan. I'm going to spend every afternoon at Schwab's drugstore. You know, where Tina Turner was discovered.
Uh-huh. Except it's a Virgin megastore now.
Are people still discovered there?
Yes, but mainly in the men's room by undercover cops.
Hey, how you doing? This is Evie Harris.
Hi, I'm the star of the movie, Varla Jean Merman.
Hello, I'm Miss Coco Peru.
Watching Girls Will Be Girls, so many things came to mind, many of them even pleasant. Let's talk about the elephant in the room. Varla, although you...
Oh, dear.
...have generously referred to this as an ensemble effort, it must be gratifying to be singled out by all the critics as the breakthrough star of the film.
Huh?
Really? Well, that's wonderful.
What critics? That's what I want to know. The buzz around my house is that I'm pretty hysterical in this film.
And you're buzzed.
Well, Evie, let's talk about that. You played movie Evie. I'm not really sure where the characters start and you end, because you are Evie Harris and you play Evie in the film. A great departure. And you play it with what seemed to be little makeup and bad lighting, letting the audience see every last crag and bag on your tired, worn face. Why that unusual choice?
Huh? Now, everyone has seen me be beautiful in films. And
When would that be?
Everyone's seen me be beautiful on stage in Vegas and in New York on the Broadway stage in Vaudeville. But in this movie, I try to strip away some of the layers and tell the real truth about what it's like being a huge, huge star in Hollywood.
You are a huge star, and you know, big girls deserve a big screen. Are there any plans to present this in the IMAX format?
Oh, that's exciting. Well, I would hope, but we're hoping for Girls Will Be Girls on Ice. That's what we're hoping. Oh, dear.
Hold on a second. It's my agent. Hello, Ron? Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I'm doing an interview right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going great. Oh, yeah, it's a hoot. We're all sitting here naked. No, he said he wouldn't mind. Uh-huh. Oh, he's charming. Yeah. No. Tiny. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Wait, he's looking at me now. I gotta go. Okay, I'll talk to you later.
So many films these days are released at the same time as the video game version. Are there any plans for a Girls Will Be Girls video game?
Oh, sure, yeah. I know that most 13-year-old boys like to imagine themselves as aging women.
This is a question for all three of you. Who would you like to play your character in the big-budget remake?
Susan Sarandon.
Nicole Kidman.
Me! Why the hell not? I got my agent working on it already.
What do you want people to take away from this film?
Hopefully they'll bring more people, and then they'll pay to see it, and then they'll buy the video, and we'll make money. That's what I really would like.
Yeah, Ron, don't talk to me now. We're busy. I'm going to tell him what I want people to take away from the film. Okay, I'll tell him. He says I should tell you that I want people to take away from this film just the idea that everyone can just love each other and be happy. Okay, I told him. Now, personally, between you and me, I'd like people to leave this movie and buy more Evie Harris products. Now, I have a line of perfume coming out soon, and I have a wig line called Evie Weavies. And they're fantastic for women who's losing their hair. Coco, I'm going to send you a couple free ones soon.
What side of the bed did you wake up on this morning? Evie? She's just a big old haggy drunk. See what I mean? We'll have someone clean that up.
Oh, my shoes.
Despite my keen journalistic powers of observation and our nudity, I was stunned when the girl suddenly announced,
"Hi, I'm Clinton Loop."
Jack Plotnick.
Jeff Roberson.
Yes, they were men. I covered myself with a Dixie cup and ran down the hall to the office of the film's writer-director, Richard Day.
Oh, wait a minute. You're saying that the women in your film were not played by women? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, with the exception of Jack, they're all men, yes. Actually, do you know what's funny? Every single female character in our role is played by a man, including when Varla has a flashback to when she was 7 years old. We got a little boy and dressed him up like a girl.
And there was a therapist on the set?
What's funny is the casting director said, "I won't even send out that breakdown because it will just, you won't get anybody to play that role and it'll be very difficult for me to field the angry phone calls." But in fact, there was this wonderful little boy that showed up and did a great job, and his mother was on the set, and he was having a really good time, I think. Later he'll write an awful book about it, I'm sure.
Look at me, then you'll see all around you. It's glittery and flashy tonight. It's all about Evie tonight. It's special and dreamy. It's all about Evie. So come and look at me tonight. Thanks for tuning in to my special commercial. Look at me!
And what do audiences have to say about Girls Will Be Girls? Excuse me, miss. An opinion on the movie?
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty. I can't stand it anymore.
She says that like it's a bad thing. But the truth is, on its way to the multiplex, Girls Will Be Girls was a hit at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It played to acclaim at lesbian and gay film festivals in San Francisco, Los Angeles, London, Miami, and Portland. Its trio of stars tied for Best Actress at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, and Best Actor at Outfest in Los Angeles, where it also won Best Screenplay. For more information on the film, point your internet browser to girlswillbegirlsmovie.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
So listen to what we say. Girls will be girls. Girls will be girls. Always and forever. Girls will be girls. You're never ever gonna change their ways.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Fensberry, Rex Walkner, Graham Underhill, Caitlin Perry, Michael Schembri, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Omar Farouk Tekbilek performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Tasman FM, Nubina, Tasmania, WWUH West Hartford, Connecticut, KDHX St. Louis, Missouri, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We do hope you'll stay tuned.